This is iRadio's group chat. If you're talking about it,
we're talking about it
on iRadio.
Tonight on iRadio's group chat, we're talking about something that doesn't always get the attention it deserves. The rising rate of female homelessness and addiction in Ireland. And a Rock This committee recently heard that more women are sleeping rough and that demand for female beds in the homeless system is growing. Behind those statistics are real people, real fear and real stories. One of those voices is someone many may know. Former radio DJ Nikki Hayes has spoken publicly about how her struggle with alcoholism led to her losing her home and spending 3.5 months sleeping rough in Dublin. She's since shared her experience with politicians in the hope that real change can happen. Nikki, thank you for joining me on iRadio's group chat this evening. I know you've spoken very openly about your journey. For people that maybe are hearing about you and this journey for the first time this evening, can you take me back to the start?
So, okay, I'm from Bray in County Wicklow, and I was born into an alcoholic home. So my father was an alcoholic and he went to treatment in the Rutland Centre when I was 4. And he stayed sober until he died when I was 27. So he had a great long sobriety. But what I have learned since doing my own treatment is my dad never dealt with his behaviour. So even though he was substance free, didn't touch another drink till the day he died, still he had alcoholic behaviours, which meant that our house was always chaotic. You know, him and my mum would be, you know, shouting and there would be doors banging, and it was chaotic. It was absolutely chaotic. I mean, if we had to get up early to go to, you know, the airport, he'd be up maybe 3 hours before, that causing chaos. And it's only now through the knowledge I have that I know that that's actually the addictive behaviours that were going on. So, you know, I spoke to my mum recently and she said she was pulled in by a school teacher when I was 4, who alerted her to the fact that she thought there was something going on with me behaviourally and personality wise, but they didn't deal with it at the time. So as I got a little bit older, and especially when I got into my teens, mental health issues start coming to the forefront. And I had an eating disorder. I had many attempts with suicide, self-harm. You know, this was consistent kind of throughout my teenage years. But also when I was 11, I had my first drink. So if you think all that was going on and then you're adding alcohol into the middle of this, it's an absolute time bomb. But I have to say the reason that I did it is I always wanted to belong. I always wanted to fit in and I never did. I was never someone's best friend. I was never the favorite sister. I was always the one, the black sheep. And for me then, when I had that drink, people were like, oh, you're funny. You're gas. You're great crack. So I was like, deadly. This actually works for me. So it became a bit of a coping skill. And as life went on and different things happened, it became my crutch. So it consistently showed its head. It consistently came up, like when someone would die in the family or if there was a tragedy, it would be me going back to the substance time and time again. So, you know, that's kind of the loophole into the bomb that went off.
Talk to me then about the bomb that did go off in your life. I know you're sharing this as well on the Iraq This the other day.
Yeah. So what happened to me was, you know, like I said, I went in and out of the addiction being a huge issue. I met a really great guy and we had a beautiful daughter. And when she was born, I had postnatal depression. And I learned that actually with the personality disorder that still was undiagnosed at this stage, that postnatal depression was a high probability of happening to me. So, you know, I went back drinking again, obviously with a newborn. This was crazy. The primary care nurse was like, you know, no, there's something going on here. She referred me back to mental health services and I had an acute mental breakdown. And it was only when they took me into the psychiatric unit for 2 months that they analysed what was going on and they joined all the dots and they were like, nah, there's something else going on here. And they diagnosed borderline personality disorder. Now that gave me so many answers because it answered everything to what was going on in my life, all the chaos and craziness. But at the time, my consultant, Dr. Curran, actually said, do you know what? We think there's an alcohol dependency going on here that's actually fueling this and making it 10 times worse. I just was not ready to give up at that stage. I wasn't ready to admit that there was an issue. So, you know, yes, I had borderline personality disorder diagnosed and that was great. And I was getting treatment for that. But I was still drinking while I was on very heavy psychotics, you know, so it became a huge, huge battle. And, you know, my marriage suffered because, you know, it was a chaotic home and my marriage broke up and my daughter lived with me for a number of years, but my drinking was getting out of hand and she went to live with her father and then COVID hit and my wheels came off. I mean, anything that I was doing, any way of functioning just was gone. And I would drink day and night. I would drink until maybe 6 in the morning because think about it, we were broadcasting from home. I had a home studio. I didn't have to get up and, you know, report to somebody. So I would drink and then go on air and send slurs. And my boss, you know, he tried working with me, but then eventually he was like, we're going to have to let you go. So I lost my job in the middle of COVID then as well. And at this point, none of my family were talking to me since Farah went to live with her dad. None of my friends were talking to me because I was starting to hang around with a really bad crowd. So I literally had isolated myself from absolutely everyone and everything. And I found myself around some very, very not nice people. And the guards called them unsavory, and I would say quite dangerous people as well. But I had them in my house and in my home. And during that time, then, just to add another bit onto the fire, my landlady gave me notice to quit, that she was going to sell the house. And most people would, you know, save for a deposit, but I didn't. I continued drinking and funding everybody that was coming in and out of my home. So I ended up homeless. I went to stay with one of these people for a week or two, and then things became very volatile. I had to leave in the middle of the night. It was quite dangerous. And myself and my cat ended up on the streets of Dublin, sleeping rough, and I stayed there for 3.5 months.
God, that's just, I'm so sorry. Like, to see you in so much better of a place now and to be speaking about this, which we'll get back to in a minute, is so amazing. But I can't even imagine what that must have been like for you at that time, and just the burden that you must have felt. Did you feel that there was a lot of misunderstanding at the time about addiction? You know, you said that you hadn't really maybe kind of accepted that that was where, you know, that the alcohol was an issue. But did you feel very misunderstood just in general?
I went into an alcohol, when you're in addiction, you're very selfish. It's all about you. And I've learned this as I've gone through my treatment. So I actually thought, you know, gosh, isn't she a terrible mother? Isn't she a terrible this? You know, all them turning their back on me. And then the judgment and stigma that I was getting from other people, like, who obviously didn't know anything about addiction. I didn't either. But, you know, we're kind of going, what kind of a mother does that? You know, chooses alcohol over their child. So there was a lot of stigma, a lot of judgment. I didn't really understand what was going on, because I still didn't understand that I had an issue. But I felt very guilty. I felt very shameful. And to be honest with you, that's something I still carry today. And I'm working through with a therapist. But when the guilt gets a hold of me, it hits me and it knocks me down. You know, it's a long process, I think, this is going to be, to actually, you know, unpack everything that happened.
What made you kind of come to the conclusion that now was the right time to share this publicly? What was the motivators for that?
Well, when I was in treatment, a couple of newspapers had contacted me wanting to do the story because there was a court case. I was in treatment at the time, and Tiglin actually said, no, you know, you can't participate in that. You're in a program at the moment. So that got parked. But then as time went on and I went into transitional living, a story was going to be written, and I was kind of like, okay, I need to do this. So I spoke with Joanne Byrne from Presence Pure. She's been amazing to me over the years, such a support. And she was a great support to me during that the court case as well. So I spoke to her and said, what will I do? Like, how do I tell this story properly? And she said, well, you know, I would say go with a broadsheet, and Niamh Horan would be a great person to go with, because, you know, it's a good publication, whatever. So we decided to go with Niamh, and thank God, because she handled the story so sensitively. She came out to Bray and met me, and we sat down for about an hour and a half and had a couple of coffees and chatted. And, you know, I got upset while I was talking to her. She got upset listening to the story. This was the first time I was telling it outside my program, so the impact of it was quite high. But, you know, it just felt like the right time. I had just finished my treatment, and I wanted to tell the story from my perspective, because this happened to me, and I didn't want it to be written about me.
To be able to open up about your own story, I imagine, is even another step on the recovery journey, because they do say that this is all a journey. And it's amazing that you're able to talk about it with such clarity as well. I think it conveys the story very, very well. We feel like we're there with you on the journey. But to talk about what you were talking about in the Oireachtas the other day, I know that the Oireachtas committee's recently heard that there are more women sleeping rough, and that the demand for female beds in the homeless system is growing.
Yes.
What were your thoughts on that when you were chatting in front of these politicians? And why do you feel it's so important for politicians to hear real stories from real people?
Well, because I find since talking in the recovery circles, there's very few women that speak out. I mean, there's Ruth Ann who speaks out, and she speaks out about time in prison and addiction. I've been speaking out, but there's very few women. Brenda Dennehy has, but very, very few women, and a lot of men. If you look at all the men on social media and doing podcasts and stuff talking about homelessness and addiction, there's loads. You talk about women, very few. You could probably count them on one hand. So I felt I needed to lend my voice to this. And because I've gone through homelessness and addiction, and also because I'm going through, you know, rebuilding, which is an ongoing thing, I felt they needed to hear this. And also one thing that I've really found completely shocking through this whole process is that there is only one facility in the entire country of Ireland that will let you come with your child. Now, your child has to be under six. That's cool mine. But they only have enough beds for 17 women and 27 children. And that's for the entire country. Now, they have got a facility in Limerick as well. But even if you double that, that's still for the entire country. It's crazy. And like, I was very blessed because my daughter has a wonderful father who took her when things were going bad with me and she had to be removed from my care. And she's thriving. But, you know, I shared treatment. I shared rooms with women who, one girl had three kids in three separate foster homes, and she finished her program and then she battled to get her kids back. So there is a protocol for Tusla to come in and take the children, but there is absolutely no protocol to reintegrate them with their mothers. And this, to me, is just ludicrous. We've done the work. We've built up our lives. We're doing absolutely everything right. And at the same time, we're not with our children. So, you know, there's huge, huge gaps in services. And another thing that since my story came out last May, that I've been contacted by thousands and thousands of people. And the one thing they keep on saying is there's no connection in services. So like, I've had women from Mayo ringing me saying, you know, I'd love to go to Tighlin, but it's in Wicklow, or I'd love to go to Cumann, but it's in Dublin. What's up in my area? There is actually places there, but just nothing connects. There's no framework. And it's like everything is silo, and we need to try and get something together, like an app or something that you put in what your addiction is, where you are, what your circumstances are, and it will give you the service, whether it be peer-led, community-led, whatever it is, it will give you the one nearest you. So, you know, I've got two wonderful women working on that with me at the moment. We're trying to come up with it. That's Tracy Carroll. She's a disability advocate, and Gail Ralph, who's with Fine Gael. So, you know, we're trying to come up with this in our own time, at our own expense, and hopefully something comes of it.
Do you think that there is more of a stigma for women versus men when it comes to addiction? As you touched on there, it doesn't seem that there are as many women in any capacity, not near as many, opening up about their experiences. That's particularly predominantly an issue with women.
Yeah, there's a massive, massive stigma with women. Like, for some reason, when you're a woman, and especially when you're a mother, it's considered, you know, oh my God, how bad are you choosing addiction over your child? And you know what? If it was a choice, nobody would make it. I mean, it's ludicrous. I mean, you know, addiction is insanity. There's no way you would choose it. But unfortunately, when addiction has a hold on you, you know, you don't have that choice anymore. It chooses for you.
It's an interesting way of putting it, for sure. And I think that'll really hit home for people. Like, if it was a choice, people wouldn't be making it at all. Like, because it is such an awful place to be in. And I'm so glad that you've, you know, got yourself back to the life that you deserve to be living for yourself and for your family. What change would you like to see happen in Ireland immediately to reduce the amount of people being homeless due to addiction? I know we talked there a lot about plans that I'm sure will need time to be enacted, but what do you think will be done right now?
Well, right now there's a lot of buildings in Ireland that are lying vacant, and some landlord is consistently getting money for them, you know, which that should be open. If there's vacant buildings, open them, let people be in them. We need more supported living. You know, there's a lot of people on the streets that I pass day in, day out, who very clearly to me, because you can't get a kid or in addiction, and you know, they need supported living. No point in putting them in an apartment on their own. So there's a lot more that needs to be done on the base level, but straight away open up these vacant buildings, you know, without a doubt, and more support for people, even if it's the outreach teams being having more support in addiction training. We just need to do more investment all over. It's not good enough.
If there's someone listening to you right now, particularly a woman who might feel like they're in a similar situation as you have been in the past, what would your piece of advice be for them?
My call is always, please don't wait until you lose everything like I did. You can rebuild. It will take time, but it's worth it. But reach out your hand. Someone is always there to help you. Reach out and grab their hand, because it will be okay.
Mickey, thank you so much for those beautiful words. And I really appreciate you joining me on iRadio's group chat. The best of luck with the rest of the campaign. I'm sure that this will be ongoing and continuous, and I hope that you get all the support that you deserve with it.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
This is iRadio's group chat. If you're talking about it,
we're talking about it
on iRadio.